a shower. It's decreed that people rule.
This is Somi, and you're listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM, hands-on creative community radio for Greene and Columbia County.
Welcome to the video rental store in your mind.
Looking for something to watch, but feeling overwhelmed by all the options?
Feeling unsatisfied with all the boring, restrictive categories like romance and drama or horror?
Tune in to Dim the Lights with Jenny and Amanda every second and fourth Tuesday at 7 p.m. and get turned on to movie genres like eco-horror,
unsettling kids' movies,
alien boyfriends,
creepy therapy.
Start listening so you can start watching today.
As 2025 comes to a close and we move into 2026, we're expanding the WGXC Catskill Studio, and we need your support. Help us grow this space in the coming year for community programming, workshops, in-studio performances, and more. Your donation to Wave Farms WGXC Radio for Open Ears contributes to the expansion of community radio on air, online, and on Main Street. Go to wgxc.org/donate now to make your contribution. And as always, we thank you for your support.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Emily Chimides of Hudson, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC, hands-on, listener-supported radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
Hey, Uncontaminated Sound listeners. As we wrap 2025, it's my great pleasure to present to you the final Uncontaminated Conversation of the year with my friend and mentor, art director, and now author, Kevin Banks. While pre-recorded on December 3rd, 2025, Kevin and I catch up and have a raw conversation about his new book, Sloan, The Art School Underworld of 80s NYC, a memoir of sorts chronicling his heady art school days in 80s NYC, a period that truly could not be replicated present day. I hope this conversation brings some listeners back to a special and uniquely creative and unfiltered period of the city that never sleeps. Just an FYI, this conversation does mention past reflections of being a youthful art student in 80s New York, with possibly some mention of use of booze and drugs, which represent Kevin's life experience trying to discover his artistic prowess. So please enjoy this heady New York City conversation. Hey, Kevin, welcome to Uncontaminated Sound.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah. So I refresh my memory. Where did we first meet? Was it 2013 already or 14 or in Boston?
I think. I'm pretty sure that you came to a DLF networking party in Kenmore Square. I think that was it.
And for the listeners in Accra, Catskill, and upstate New York, what does DLF stand for?
DLF was the Design Liberation Front, which was a cheeky title for a networking group that I put together when my coworkers and I were getting frustrated with, you know, our long hours and low salary at a Boston area media company. So we would go down to Kenmore Square and take over a pub. And at one point I just put a name on it.
Yeah. And as I recall from that night with your crew, that was an interesting night that ended up with a motel's door being broken down at the end of the night, which was fairly interesting. But for some context to any listeners out there, I was pursuing, from a criminal justice background, design, and I met Kevin at a portfolio review, and we swiftly kind of became friends, and he's helped me out ever since, kind of as a kind of art director, and just the waxing poetics regarding the industry in general. But flashing back to those days in Boston, and it's just a vague memory now. I can't believe how time flies and is distorted, but that rings a bell. That's a very vivid memory for myself.
2010.
But, yeah. Or yeah. 2014 or when yeah. that motel get
motel
together.
Was, yeah. It was 2013. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that motel party was, you know, an after party for one of the pub DLF mixers, which for your listeners was really an excuse for a lot of middle-aged guys and girls to get together and put away a ton of beer at a discount, which was nice because the proprietor was a friend of mine. And that particular winter, it was about this time of the month. I think it was like December 3rd or 4th or something. And that was the DLF Christmas party. Which got a lot, you know, twice as many people. A lot of my friends from the School of Visual Arts and the Sloan Dormitory, which we'll get into, drove up from New York and joined us in Boston. And, you know, I think in a lot of times when you get your friends together, you revert to a your youth, you know, your beer drinking youth styles, and you get rowdy. And we did get rowdy, which was fun. And, you know, there was a photographer that was hired for the event, and he caught most of it. And it's just phenomenal to look at those photos now, because you're like, what a bunch of meatheads and morons, because we were, you know, in our early 40s. And I had I was teaching at design at Suffolk University and invited some grad students. So now you've got 40 something dudes and some, you know, 20 something grad student, male and female. And just that age gap made for a really funny dynamic, and heavy, heavy, heavy amount of drinking. I was no angel either, but, you know, it went all night, and a lot of things got smashed and broken. And a couple of individuals pulled a Keith Moon here, yep. And there, you know, there was a food fight even, you know, so it really devolved into a mess, but in the best way. And that marked the end of DLF.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was a spectacular end, at least on that note. So just for any listeners out there that are unfamiliar with your work, could you just briefly give some you know, background on your career a bit, and what you do now and how you get started? Yeah.
I think I would call myself I just like the word art director because it's so general.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think creative director is kind of an abused title. So I don't, everybody's a creative director now. So I don't use it. Or sometimes I just use regular guy because yeah. I don't want any title. I don't want any attention. But the backstory truth there is that I'm an artist and now an author, which seems kind of strange. and which is the whole motivation for us getting together, is to talk about this new book that I busted out of the visual arts world and went into writing, and in that trespassing produced, self-published, 99% true story about living in an art school dormitory in the middle of New York City in the mid 80s. And it was the Wild West for creativity, art, and drugs. And it was a lot of fun and made for, a pretty killer book. I think a lot of it has to do with, I don't want to say the C word, but I will, COVID. And how did you pass the time during COVID? And for me, it was, I was doing one pagers, just little stories about, the good old days. And I would admit that, am I a 50 something guy talking about my glory days? Yes. But I'm doing it in a context of celebration, to have survived them, and the context between 1985 and 2025 is the foundation of the book.
Yeah. And that the title of the book is Sloan, the Art School Underworld of 80s NYC.
Correct. Thank you. It came out not a few months ago.
Of course.
And people have gone wild. I had a book release signing last month in Midtown on the High Line next to the Pigeon, and which is Sloan's mascot, happened to be, from the early days, was a pigeon with a cigarette. So it was only too appropriate to have the signing in that reunion under that pigeon sculpture, which is currently in Midtown on the High Line. But as far as answering your question, I'm like a freelance art director now, and I do a lot of writing and a lot of contract freelance for branding, identity for agencies, big and small. And as much as the industry got its butt kicked, like a lot of industries post COVID, and is struggling to come back, and a lot of people are like, well, what do I do, and where are my clients? And I went through that period, a little bit of grieving and wandering around, and then instead of just moping and writing about it on LinkedIn, I decided to just say, these are valuable days, because I could be for working full time next week. So I use every day as a day to produce my own work.
Yeah.
Artwork and writing. And I think it's a gift, because I remember, 10, 20 years ago, you're in an office at 7 o'clock, just hungry and hoping to go home and, see your wife and kids, a salary guy. And, there's that life. And it was very, I don't know, insert the adjective here. Supportive, useful, necessary, and educational. But now things have changed, and so what do you do with your creative self? And for me, it's I make a variety of artwork, illustrations, large pieces, graphics, I breathe Photoshop, so I'm kind of a mutant in that respect. And then as I use the word trespassing to describe, publishing a book about art school and stuff like that, I feel like I was out of my lane, and that's what made it fun.
Yeah.
So those one pagers became 10 pagers, and the 10 pagers became 40 chapters. And the 40 is important because it was, 40 years ago was 1985.
Well, on that, on process real quick, did you approach this writing project comparatively to your visual stuff? Like, was there a different mindset for you?
Yeah, totally. And, behind, every successful guy or semi-successful, there is a lady, and my wife is the brains of this duo. And she pointed out, after listening to Sloan stories for close to 20 years and encouraging me to write them down, she said, I know you don't consider yourself a writer, but you have a particular voice, and you should collect these things up and do something with them. And I was like, no, I'm just happy to, watch a football game and write one page about something that happened at Sloan. But my process was, and this is probably, you know, in retrospect, I realized what I didn't have a process. I would write, believe it or not, when I did not use Microsoft Word or any like book writing software, I used InDesign. Because InDesign is the software, you know, my creative playground for the past 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And I was at the media group, and it's the place where I'm the most free. And, you know, if you're working on an InDesign project, you know, layout or something, and you have that pasteboard off to the sides, and I would literally just make a box and start typing in it. So it was my sticky note. And those boxes were everywhere. So then I would make another InDesign file and throw all the text boxes into that. And those text boxes, I would turn into what I called a one pager. It was a story about how, you know, me and my friends from Sloan skateboarded up to Central Park and did this, or we went to see the movie Platoon and, you know, we all got high before that. And that was one page. And then to turn it into 10 pages, and this is the process, it's just adding clay to it, adding words to it, and editing it for 4 years. That's what I did for 4 years. And at the end of the third year, it occurred to me that there was a book here. And my wife is in publishing, you know, a executive editor at a publishing company. And so she's encouraging and sort of steering me in the right direction, but by no means was involved in editing it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she works hard enough all week long. And I said, you know, let me do this and you do you, and I'll keep it out of your world. So it doesn't, I know that she wanted to contribute. She ended up contributing a ton once the book was finished on marketing initiatives and ideas, and said to, you know, to reach out to people. And I think that's how, you know, we're talking tonight is, you know, I've always considered myself like a picture guy, a design guy, a quiet guy, not a big talker, as you can tell. But when there is something on my mind, I can go off for hours. And Sloan is pretty easy to talk about. You and I have had a lot of great conversations about art, design, the industry, just like the ups and the downs. And so to do a book was scary. But I guess, you're in your 50s, you just don't care anymore what people think. You're just going to go do it.
Yeah.
And I needed to get it done, because to have, you know, 40 InDesign files on my desktop forever, they had to go somewhere. And, you know, it would have been like a brain tumor to just not process those and publish them and put them somewhere. And I didn't know it was going to happen at all. The only thing I did, which I considered smart, was hire a publishing consultant, which was a man, a small company, a guy had started his own publishing consulting firm out of Alabama. And he even lowered his fee after reading some chapters because he wanted to work with me. And because it was mostly done, he helped me realize which chapters were the best, what order to put them in for readability, and then how to format it and open up the Amazon experience and make it, you know, book ready, which was fascinating. Because if I were to leave anything with your listeners, I would say, just do it. Just go do it. It's not that hard.
Yeah. And
now that I've been through one book, there's another one on the way. You know, there's probably I'm not sure what I would call it, but there is another book coming.
Interesting. Yeah. Before I ask you about that, let's flash back to actually New York City and how you got there in the first place, and how this book and your experiences in New York City in Sloan and in art school led to the book ultimately coming to fruition.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I grew up just outside Boston, a small town, small suburb, and it was very generic, and it was great. But, you know, I was a bit of a troublemaker and had a couple brushes with the law, I had the handcuffs, and at 16 and stuff like that. But I was producing artwork all the time. And I had an art teacher who put his finger in my face one day and said, "You have skills, but you're kind of an idiot. You need to grow up." And it just changed everything for me. And he helped me put a portfolio together in my sophomore or junior year, I think it was. So I was ready to roll.
Yeah.
And he pointed me in the right direction, you know, to Mass Art or RISD or New York or Pratt, Parsons, where you want to go. And it really lit a fire. And under that motivation, the rest of my grades started to perk up enough that I did get into the School of Visual Arts and moved to New York in the fall of 85.
Yeah.
Into a building, which the official name was Sloan House YMCA. Mm. It was literally a YMCA called the William J. Sloan House on 34th and 9th Ave. And it just looked like it sounds, like a nasty YMCA, 15 floors of, you know, brick and despair. But four different art schools leased floors of the building. So half of the building, and I'm talking like, I think it was Parsons, FIT, NYU, or New School, and SVA. And SVA had 8, 9, and 10. And the rest of the buildings, I would say maybe six other floors, were transients or outpatients from a mental hospital or international students, which was always fun. So it was quite the world. It was, you know, just, it was like a city within a city.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun and gross and weird. And we were all, you know, highly inebriated and caffeinated and with our hormones raging, 20-year-olds, 19 and 20-year-olds. And there weren't any rules.
Yeah.
Except for no fighting. You couldn't fight.
Yeah.
Not that anybody wanted to, because we were too busy, you know, making art, drinking, doing drugs, getting laid, and just really enjoy making music. You know, bands popped up, arts, you know, the art school bands popped up. Some of them were successful. And one of them came out of my crew, which was the Sloan Rangers, you know, the tongue in cheek name, played. And it wasn't me. I was the Malcolm McLaren of the Sloan Rangers, where I did the advertising and I was a mediator, and I was a bit of a roadie, you know, whatever needed. But the other two guys in the book were part of the band, two-thirds of the band. So, you know, that's a whole chapter or two, how that happened.
Yeah.
We also, through that camaraderie, became president, vice president, and treasurer of the SVA student government through that energy.
Interesting.
As well as we were featured in some film students' short films. You know, so there's so much to do. But I remember a lot of time being spent on, you know, sex, drugs, and alcohol. I think it was reflective of the age. But I can be quite honest with your listeners that there is nothing more fascinating than taking a head full of mushrooms and couple of pitchers of beer with your best friends and trudging through Times Square like you're at the edge of the universe.
Yeah.
For 5 hours, and then finding a building that you can access the roof and then pissing off that roof into Times Square. You know, so that's the essence of the book right there, is that debauchery. You know, I won't sugarcoat it, but there's a lot of drug and alcohol references. And somebody had asked me recently on another discussion, you know, why so many, you know, drugs, and what was it? And I was like, well, you know, there's always this need to alter your state. Maybe it's not a need, but a want. And at least for me, you know, to be laughing for 3 or 4 hours with your best friends is sort of like you're laughing at life and laughing at the world.
Yeah.
But I had a notebook, and I would draw diagrams, I would write down sentences, and try to track some sort of progress from mushroom trip to mushroom trip to learn from it, and to in some cases use those memories as content for artwork. You know, I remember being surrounded by a pack of skinheads one time down a West 4th subway stop, and we were tripping balls. And it was terrifying. It was like stormtroopers or something. But that ended up becoming content for a illustration series that ended up getting into my first exhibit. So you can see that, you know, the ends doesn't justify the means, but there is a way to turn it into content. And I'm not recommending that life to anybody. I'm not going to pull a Hunter Thompson or anything like that, because I think in retrospect, drugs and alcohol just slow you down.
Yeah, yeah.
And in your 50s, they'll just kill you.
Well, yeah, a lot of those so-called greats didn't make it past, is it the 27 Club, per se? But
yeah, yeah. Morrison and
yeah,
Kurt Cobain and Joplin. But I didn't want to end up like, you know, Thompson was one of my heroes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Kurt Vonnegut, Bukowski, Hunter Thompson. I didn't have, you know, baseball players or football players that I idolized in high school. I had writers and artists like Francis Bacon and Stedman, you know, so that's how I got into Thompson, through Stedman, Ralph Stedman. And my friends and I think we passed paperbacks. It was ninth grade, middle school, or ninth grade or 10th grade, all of Thompson's works. And then because you're a dumb teenage boy, you will try to live that lifestyle and do the drugs and drink, you know, whiskey and stuff like that. I think a lot of what Thompson did was his writing, you know, everybody knows it was spectacular. And I think I've read probably 90% of his work. But I'm frustrated, you know, he killed himself and he destroyed himself slowly and, you know, can barely even talk towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the price you pay for art or die for your art, but I chose to recognize his quote, which was, you know, buy the ticket, take the ride, which I did, my friends and I did. But I want to add something to that quote, which is buy the ticket, take the ride, and then get off the ride before it kills you. Mm. So I got off the ride about 4 years ago and just went totally sober and clean. And then that is when I started producing the best work of my life. So if I can leave anything with you guys listening, is focus, you know, clean up and focus, and then go back into your work with a fresh set of eyes and see what happens.
Yeah, so... That's a good point. You know, there's all this mythologies, this mythology of being tormented artists, you know, you gotta be messed up, you know, or just like to have these, all these dark experiences,
in your 20s. It's
yeah.
Okay in
yeah.
Your 20s. It kind of works bar stool to bar stool, you know, it kind of works. And yeah. I think a lot of these stories were workshopped from barstool in my 40s, no less, from barstool to barstool. And I think that the voice in the book is like two guys talking at a bar, which is a different type of English. It's very clipped and very, it's gross and
yeah.
It's R-rated. You know, somebody called the book vulgar and disturbing, and which is, you know, a badge of honor because the book is honest. You know, and it's not like I had to make anything up. I just reported on what we did and put it into readable chapters.
And speaking on that note, who's the narrator in this book? Is it yourself, or is it the abstraction of yourself, or how did you write that in what perspective?
That is a really good question. I'm glad you got on that. It's me.
Yeah.
However, everyone in the book, I've changed their names, you know, slightly. So Kevin becomes Evan, you know, and the rest of my friends. And it focuses on me and my two buddies, which were my next door neighbors, who I just referred to as comrades, because I think friends is boring. But yeah, they were comrades because, you know, we took care of each other and we grew this little fascist empire, creative empire within the building. And had a really good time with it. The thing I'm proud about is that we weren't ever malicious. You know, we didn't surround people in the subway and threaten to stab them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
you know, nothing against the Skins, you know, but, you know, do your Skin thing. But no, we didn't need to, you know, abuse or fight people for bravado. If anything, we were damaging ourselves and our own livers.
Yeah.
But the book is me, I would say Evan, Ryan, and Jack. And the power there is that Evan, Ryan, and Jack had the same motivations, which is art, sex, drugs, and music, but three very different characters. You know, I was the quiet guy, the strategist. Ryan was, you know, a large, kind of like a football-sized, player-sized guy, brilliant, and kind of made sure that everybody got home. And then Jack was, I think he was like the id, he would, the pit bull, like he would, I would say the most, the, you know, flannel, the combat boots, the punk rock guy, you've seen him. But he had like a soft inner heart and stuff, yeah, that girls loved, you know. So three different guys, and the beauty of it is that we never really had to compete with each other, or I'm sure we pissed each other off from time to time, but a day later, nobody cared. So as a trio, we got a lot done. As I mentioned earlier, the band, the student government, the art projects, the parties, and a lot of mischief, you know, drug, alcohol trips. And if I could dive into the drug usage for a minute, it was very specific, not cocaine, because it was too expensive. And in the mid-80s, cocaine was a yuppie drug, or Wall Street or something like that. And, you know, acid popped up here and there, but I found acid a little predictable and kind of boring. Yeah. You know, if the walls are breathing and the floor is melting and, you know, you look in a mirror and your face is starting to fall off, I mean, it's okay the first time, second time, but the third time it gets a little redundant. But mushrooms were a whole different ballgame. They appeal to the visual side of me and my crew, where, you know, the first thing that happens after eating mushrooms, about 40 or an hour later, everything is saturated. All colors are saturated and light becomes, I would say, 50% brighter. So you could, it could be the middle of winter in Sloan and it looks like a sunshiny day.
Mm.
And never forget that. But it also manages your thoughts in a way that you look at things, I would say you look at things from backstage. You look at, you know, a taxi, you know, being able to hail a taxi. I'm like, well, there's this yellow vehicle that stops in front of me if I raise my arm this high. But what if I raise it only this high?
Mm.
So you start playing with those things. And what if I get in the taxi and I give it an address and then I don't pay? I just get out and walk away. So you could do that. In New York in the mid-80s, I mean, you could get beat up, shot, or stabbed. But yeah, as far as getting arrested, you had to really try hard to get arrested. And we did. And we never got arrested.
Wow.
You'd have to set a bunch of nuns on fire or, like, take shit on the, Empire State Building lobby or something. And maybe they would just say, go home.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, there's the whole white privilege thing. Like, we were three skinny little white boys from the suburbs, and nobody cared what we did. You know, we were untouchable. It was very strange, and we knew that. So, you know, rolling through Times Square with a head full of mushrooms, acid, beer, it was a lot of fun visually. And, you know, there was only a couple times where, you know, it was cold and raining one night, and then we started to walk home and thought it would be a good idea to just take the subway instead of walking. And we're in subway tunnels, tripping in subway tunnels as trains are going by, which is not the smartest thing, because it gets really dark in the middle of the tunnels between, say, 23rd and 34th. And you think it's only 100 feet or 200 feet, but it's actually like 500 yards, maybe a quarter mile or something. It's great. And, you know, next thing you know, you're down some other tunnel and something, and you hear people talking, and they're maintenance workers, and there's the third rail to worry about. So mushrooms were a catalyst. Sometimes we take them and we go up on what is now the High Line, used to be abandoned train yards. And you know, on a warm fall night, you could bring a bunch of beer and a backpack and some shrooms and meet a bunch of strange people up on the High Line. But it was all like overgrown grass and industrial buildings and homeless people. And sometimes it was dangerous. We got attacked once, but we got out of it, mugged or something, but we fought out of it and ran off. But we always worked in small groups of three or five or something, so we were pretty safe.
Well, how did all that, like, or that drug use accelerate your creativity at the time? And how do you remember these stories now to dictate them into a novel?
That is my secret sauce, my secret weapon, which I will reveal. I mentioned earlier The Notebook, which,
yes,
you know, if you have a bunch of drinks and you write stuff down, or drugs, and you look at it the next day, it doesn't make a lot of sense. True. And a lot of times I was writing it on the pages and the letters were falling off, like, you know, leaves being blown off the street.
Yeah.
So it's tricky to get anything relevant. But being able to remember stuff, the credit really goes to Ryan. He has a memory like an elephant. So during the writing process, I would, you know, we have Zoom sessions during COVID. I would contact Jack and I would ask, like, the time, you know, that we took the shrooms and got on the Long Island Railroad and went out to Long Island and set that, you know, went to a beach and set the marsh on fire by mistake and stuff like that.
Yeah.
He has his memory of it. I have my memory of it. And Jack has his memory. And there were other characters like Paul and Bob and Patty, you know, some of the B characters in the book. So I would email them and say, so I combined a lot of that detail into a one scene. You know, were there two girls there at CBGB's or was it three? And then everything in the book hooks or is based out of Sloan, out of the dorm, but it doesn't all take place in the dorm. Like we invade NYU, we invade University of Connecticut and UMass Amherst because we wanted to see what other, you know, people had friends or connections at other schools and needed to get the hell out of Manhattan from time to time. So we'd go out to Long Island or, you know, we almost got stabbed at UConn, but, that was kind of interesting because some of the sportos didn't like us art school boys fraternizing with their lady folk. And we, you know, we all carried weapons, small weapons, just for, you know, if you're ever getting the crap kicked out of you in a bar, it's kind of nice to have a boot knife or a $20 bill to buy drinks for everybody afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Now, would you call this a more memoir or a novel per se?
Memoir adjacent.
Yes.
And I had a hard time with the publisher where I, you know, I'll tell you guys and the listeners, all this stuff happened.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a reporter, you know, I didn't have to make stuff up because the content was gold.
Yeah.
And truth is stranger than fiction. But I had to, for legal purposes and safety sake, I did change names. And in the beginning of the book, I said, this is a work of fiction, but stays true to the events as they happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. You know, that's all publishing protocol. But I think that the best part about it is, for me, and maybe for the reader, from what I'm hearing about the reviews, is that it's honest. And that the voice, the writing voice, is mine. And, you know, it is that barstool English. You know, yeah. I'm not trying to be a writer. I don't need to be a writer. I'm the picture guy. I'm the quiet picture design guy. I don't need to be a writer. But doing a graphic novel of Sloan would have probably taken 20 years. I don't have that attention span.
Yeah.
I had 4 years to watch Sloan come out of me. And I'll confess that it correlates with, you know, you quit drinking and then a book pops out because you have that mind space. Mm. So four years ago, I quit drinking and started really writing a book.
Yeah.
So four years later, you know, we're talking about Sloan. I didn't plan it that way, but that's what happened. I'm happy that happened. It kind of speaks to, you know, buying the ticket, taking the ride, getting off the ride. And I didn't know what was going to happen when I got off the ride. So I think I sort of hid behind, you know, more artwork, writing about my youth and my friends and not giving a damn what becomes of it, you know. And I mentioned earlier, once you get in your 50s, you just don't care about people think anymore.
Yeah.
I care about, I'm sure my wife does too, and you can relate, is that you care about what you're contributing to the world and what you're going to leave behind. And if I can be an 85-year-old guy like my dad and read about me and my friends messing around Midtown and having drinks at CBGB's in the mid-80s, which was, you know, practically a century ago.
Yeah.
That's going to be fun. So I'm glad I got it done. I encourage any of your listeners that even if they haven't started or they have 25 pages of a book and they're feeling about it, don't quit. I know it's discouraging and it's hard, but if I can do it, you can do it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a writer. And then the surprise at the end was, you can see a little chart on the Amazon portal of book sales. You know, on the first day I sold 10, and the second day it was 12, and the third day it was 14, and it just kept going up and up and up and up. And, you know, full disclosure, I am the administrator of the Sloan Facebook group.
Yeah.
So I had a bit of a built-in audience there. But once, you know, there's about, I think there's about 400 members now.
Yeah.
But once everybody bought what, you know, who was going to buy it, then it just started, I don't know who's buying it now, but there's still 10, 15 a week going out the door.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I think it's really odd. It's a pleasant surprise. But I think it's really fun to do your podcast and talk about it. I do want people to come away with, you know, I just listened to Rob and Kevin talk about this book that he did, and he's not a writer.
Yeah.
But somehow, you know, I'm sitting next to a pile of books right now, and I still think it's really strange. Like, I go to bed at night and I see the book stacked up in my office, and I'm like, what the hell? It's just a strange little baby to birth. And it'll be around for a while. It'll be around after I'm gone.
Yeah.
I just highly recommend, because it was a very alien type of form of communication for me. Since day one, since I was 2 years old, I was Mr. Draw Pictures guy. I started with my mother's lipstick on the bedroom wall. And I've always just held on to that identity. But when COVID came in and just destroyed the industry and it replaced it with AI, for better or for worse, I didn't know what to do, and I just didn't care anymore. And I think not caring, I keep coming back to that word, trespassing.
Hmm.
It's like, I used to work for a media company, and it was a newspaper, magazines, and all that. And I remember the writers, you know, we're the writers, you're the designers, you stay over there.
Yeah.
And anytime somebody like segregates me like that, I actually got published there a couple of times, and they were amused. They're like, oh, one of the design guys wrote a story. My only reply was, well, I just hope the writer people don't design the covers. You know, so there is that bias.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're like a hockey player or a photographer or a new dad or a mom working three jobs or something, you know, but there's a story in your head, write it down.
Yeah.
You don't have to use Microsoft Word. You can use InDesign. You can use a pencil. You can use a crayon. Write them down and write with abandon. Write like you're talking to your best friend.
Yeah.
You know, don't write like you're writing a book. It doesn't have to be perfect. And then just build it, build it, build it, build it. And then when you've got enough chapters and you're happy with it, you know, contact someone and say, I need a little feedback on this. The smart guy that you used to work for, who was in the finance department, or one of the writers from the company that you used to work for who was actually nice, email a PDF and say, I just need your opinion. And I did that for a year.
Yeah.
I got feedback for about a year. And everybody was very nice. Some people were amused. They're like, look at you, writer guy. You're going to have pictures in the book? No, there are no pictures in the book. There's a couple of graphics, but that's about it.
And, well, thank you for that insight into the process and the words of wisdom on
wisdom.
That anybody could tell their story. But where can we find the book now? Just strictly on Amazon? And why did you focus on just self-publishing, I guess, and as a distribution method?
Good question, dude. Good question. I had some friends that had became first-time authors. These were folks from the media company. One guy wrote a book about I think it was about LinkedIn. Another girl wrote a book about Spotify. And they got actual, you know, they got an agent. I think they got an agent in a publishing house. And they were both so pissed off that, like, my first book, I freaking hate my publisher. They're making me do everything. I'm only making like $2 a copy, something like that. So they're very frustrated. So when I went to them for feedback on my chapters, I said, all right, what is it? Self-publishing or go with a publisher? And they said, no, self-publish it, do it however you can.
Yeah.
And, you know, Amazon became the obvious choice, but, and this is the important part, it's not the only choice. So what has happened now is I launched it with Amazon, sold a ton of books.
Yeah.
Got a lot of press and recognition. And then on Saturday, I walked into a bookstore one town over from me that has kind of eclectic collection of books and art and stuff, and inked a deal for them to sell it. And the most fascinating thing is they had already heard of it.
Oh, cool.
Which freaks through social media, which freaks me out a little bit. And it was a guy my age, like our age. And he was like, dude, I'm so glad you came in. It's like, it fits right into our collection. You know, they have a lot of New York stuff, a lot of art books, Basquiat, Warhol, Herring, a really cool book about Tompkins Square Park in 1985.
Oh, cool.
I don't know if anyone listening here remembers Wigstock, Tompkins Square. I was in the Tompkins Square Park riots accidentally. I'm not a rioter. I'm the quiet guy, right?
Yeah, yeah. You may be like Forrest Gump, though, showing up in all these important historical.
Well, I mean, in the book,
New York City events.
One of the complaints or criticisms from one of the early editors, and probably now, is that, you know, these three individuals, they're kind of sorry, can I say that? They don't have any redeeming qualities.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of the editors that I showed early drafts to, they said, you got to give the reader something to root for.
Yeah.
Some character. And I said, well, I'm going to have to make stuff up to do that. So I didn't. And so these aren't the nicest three guys in New York City. They do a lot of pranks and shenanigans and shoot fireworks down the hallway and, you know, smack, throw a lot of stuff out the windows and off the roof. I mean, Sloan had a huge, you know, no access roof that we would take the door off and access and then put it back on sort of like slightly so it looked like it was on. So we had a roof top clubhouse, which was fantastic for, you know, drinking beer under the stars. I slept up there a couple times, brought it, you know, girlfriend up there and spent the night on the roof under the stars of Manhattan. Probably the most peaceful New York experience I ever had. I think it's more about, I wasn't worried about being nice. I think we were just being ourselves.
Yeah.
The book is written that way. Like, I'm not trying to impress the reader. The story arc is what we did. That's the story arc. I mean, it's not going to be like, you know, I rescued the princess and then we blew up the Death Star of Penn Station or something. No, this is real life. And so somebody had said to me, this book is interesting because I never knew what you guys do in art school. I thought they gave you a bunch of crayons and you know, you took drugs and drew pictures of nudies all day, which is only partially true.
Yes.
Yeah. nude models. And there's a chapter about that called How to Art School. And it's not particularly flattering for the experience. It's more like wise guy, you know, guy in the back of the class, you know, throwing rolled up paper or criticizing what the teacher's wearing. Not terribly mature, but informative and a time capsule on its own.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you always want those guys to like get their comeuppance. And I don't think we ever did. You know, we got elected to run the school. They gave us offices. They gave us a $40,000 operating budget. And we threw some of the best parties in the history of the school.
Amazing. You know,
but at the Ritz and in Times Square, we had a safe sex party in Times Square that cost about $8,000 to throw.
Wow.
You know, you had to hire. I mean, I'm a 21-year-old kid. And I'm hiring bouncers, so we had to interview bouncers, which was funny. We hired a promoter. That was interesting. So he's in there too. And once the promoter got a whiff of what our budget was, we could book any club in New York that we wanted. I think we did the World, which the World became the Ritz, or Ritz became the World. We had our Halloween party there. We had a band showcase there. Fred Armisen came by. He was actually an SVA student for a while. His band was named Fred. And he dropped off a tape and we said, yeah, sure. But my favorite part of that is I hired the best graphic designer in the school to do the posters, the promos for the safe sex party in Times Square. And it was gorgeous. He did this beautiful, you know, design. I can't even begin to describe it, except for the fact that the typography was a bit flawed, where it was like blue on black.
Yeah.
So instead of saying safe sex party in Times Square, the safe word was kind of printed too dark. So it just said School of Visual Arts, Visual Arts Student Association sex party in Times Square. And we put them all over the school buildings. And their SVA had about four main buildings at the time.
Yeah.
And then we got a call from the president of the school. It's like, I highly recommend you not have your sex party in, you know, like Harrison Ford, not have your sex party in Times Square. Rethink that. And we said, okay, sir. Uh-huh. You know, from our offices on 23rd Street. Okay. We put the phone down and we said, let's start drinking, because we're not changing anything.
Yeah.
And we had, as far as sex parties, we had those in the office on 23rd Street, which not a lot of people will appreciate. We used to have to wipe down the couch on Mondays. Is that too much? Too much?
TMI? No. That's great. I guess a closing question, or kind of, who's this book for?
Like, I, of course, you have the alum of Sloan, but
well, the top of,
who's
the
this
top
book for these days?
Good question. The top of that pyramid is, like I mentioned earlier, it's a souvenir for those who survived it. And, you know, when we had the book signing and the little reunion last month in New York, one woman came out to me and said, thank you for writing this, because now I have a document to show my family and what a weird place Sloan was. And I managed to stay there for 3 years. Another person thanked me for writing it because it gave a voice and maybe some pictures to what the hell, where are art students made?
Yeah.
Where do they come from? And in the mid 80s, you know, SVA was a big deal for that. And also, to your question, who is the audience? I'm also pushing it on some of my friends who have, you know, teenagers applying to art schools and to other colleges with dormitories. And I said, read this, because this is all that can happen.
Yeah.
You know, as Sloan was very unusual, you know, sitting there on 34th and 9th. And, you know, the beginning of the book, it says we were 19 and nobody was watching, you know.
It's great. That's opening line.
Felt, yeah. 'Cause I never felt like any, even the RAs in the building, they found us, you know, they had to manage us in some way. And they only ever got on us when we were, you know, you're playing Killing Joke at full volume at 3 in the morning on a Sunday. They're like, can you turn that down?
Yeah.
But they knew we were a bit of a, you know, ninth floor mafia, so they didn't want to piss us off, because anyone who pissed us off got fireworks in front of their door. So we lit a lot of fireworks off, threw a lot of fireworks into the pit between the buildings, threw a lot of stuff off the roof for some reason. I saw a shopping cart full of paint. We stole paint out of the storage unit that the facilities people use. It was like pink. I think it was pink. It was for the ladies' room, to paint the ladies' room. Brought it up to the roof and put it in a shopping cart one night and pushed it off the roof. So we were on 34th Street, was the front of the building. The back of the building was 33rd. And then there was the big branch of the post office.
Yeah, yeah.
And it hit a mail truck. So for weeks and weeks and weeks, we'd be walking to school and we'd see the pink mail truck driving by. And it felt a little bit like a Jackson Pollock project gone awry.
Yeah, yeah.
It was some of my best work. Who is it for? Well, it's for ex-New Yorkers. It's for art school survivors, and it's for people with kids about to enter the dorm system. You know, there's a couple of chapters explaining how condoms work, which I think it's critical.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what happens when there's a crab outbreak on the next floor? Deal with that? Yeah. How to deal with it quickly?
Yeah, yeah.
that's all good information, right?
Yeah, that's important information. I don't know what goes down these days, but
the final reason is probably the biggest, is that it's been a hell of a year, right?
Yeah.
And I won't even get into it. It was kind of a crappy year for me as well. A lot of people, the ability to open this book and travel back in time to 85, I mean, there are a ton of music references, because if you think about yourself when you were 19, 18, 17, how important music was, it was your own little personal religion. So I get into, you know, the Walkman and some of the bands that we're listening to. So every chapter is drenched in musical references, but not in an obnoxious way. It was just true. Like, we were listening to Killing Joke and New Order. And obviously there's a lot of you too. I was a big U2 guy, you know, the half Irish guy from Boston. Yes, I had a lot of U2. I was in love with the early stuff. I've seen them 5 times, you know, fight me. But the music of the era, you know, of course we had Led Zeppelin. We had a lot of the Doors, you know, the good stuff. The funny thing is, I never heard anyone in Sloan listening to the Ramones. It was almost like been there, done that in 85. Like, yeah, fine. Iggy Pop. Yeah, of course. Iggy Pop in B-52s. All right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I rank on this Phil Collins, you know, Phil Collins was like a rash in the 80s.
So where can you tell our listeners where we can, so we can only find the book on Amazon or any other, where can we discover more, or they can discover more on Instagram or just Amazon?
Everything. The visual end of this reading experience exists. I put everything on Instagram
at
Sloan Book 2025, at Sloan Book 2025. That's all you need to know. It is available in a store up here in Boston that I just made a deal with, and we're going to have a book signing December 14th at a bookstore in Norwood, Massachusetts, called Specimen.
Interesting.
Which is fantastic. They have a lot of New York books, art books there. Specimen. Check out Specimen on Instagram too. Just great guys who I bonded with immediately, because, you know, similar love of art, literature, and culture and stuff.
Go
to Amazon and say Sloan Kevin Banks,
yeah,
and you'll find it as well. But some people have a little trouble with Amazon. I'm kind of like in a love hate with it as well.
Yeah,
my wife loves it, you know, delivering all the Christmas gifts and stuff. But, you know, but like, you know, like you're supposed to say, shop local.
Yeah. Any other words for the listeners? Or
well, I wanted to thank Rob at Uncontaminated Sound. If you see him, tell him I said thanks.
Yeah.
Of course, listen to Rob and Rob at Uncontaminated Sound at GXC on your radio dial.
Yeah, I've